In the movie Silver Linings Playbook, the main character, played by Bradley Cooper, comes home from a mental hospital and returns to live with his parents and try and get his life back on track. Now, he had gone to this mental hospital as part of a plea bargain because he had come home one day and found his wife in the shower with another man, and he went a little crazy and beat the man up. And as part of the criminal charges that were brought against him, he had to go to this mental hospital because he had anger management issues. Well, when he gets back from his time in the hospital, he decides he's going to try and get his life back on track, and the first thing he wants to do is get back together with his wife. His wife is a high school English teacher, if I recall correctly, and he thinks, the main character believes, that if he gets his act together by reading all of the books that his wife teaches from, that he can go and impress her with his knowledge, and that would be the first step into getting her back. So the first book that he decides to read is A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. And during the movie in the scene, you see that he is spending a lot of time reading this book. Basically, from start to finish, he doesn't take a break. And I think it's at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when he finally finishes the book. His reaction to having finished the book is a classic, which involves him being incredibly angry and frustrated with the book. If I recall correctly, he throws the book out the window, and then he stomps into his parents' room at 3 o'clock in the morning and starts ranting and raving about the book, complaining about the book, going through the plot and explaining how all these things happened and this journey that the main character had to take, all for nothing, because at the end of the book, I think the love interest dies. And he is fit to be tied. He is beside himself with anger and frustration at this book. And he needed to lay out that anger on somebody, and he needed to express to somebody how upset he was with the way that this book ended. That is the whole reason why I do this podcast. It was in that one scene where it truly encapsulated the reasons why I sit down here and I talk into this microphone for an hour at a time. It's because sometimes when you read a book, you need an outlet. You need a way to express your feelings. You need a way to sometimes vent and be upset. And I remember when I read A Farewell to Arms, I had no idea what it was about. And this was a long time ago. I think I was still in high school. But I knew it had to do with something about war. I knew Ernest Hemingway as being a classic author, which somehow or other I managed not to read while I was in high school. And so I picked up the book and had no idea. And for the first three quarters of the book, I really enjoyed it. I know it had to do with, I don't remember the war, and he was an ambulance driver during the war, and there's this great love story. And then at the end of the book, I was so disgusted with the way that it ended, and I remember specifically going to my father and saying, I don't understand, why do people read books like this? Why do they read books where the ending is so damn disappointing and sad and emotional driven? Why do people read this book? And on top of that, why is this book so spectacular? Why does everybody like this book so much? And actually, it was at that point that I kind of swore off really a lot of classics, and I swore off Hemingway books, and basically said if the idea of a classic is that it needs to be sad at the end, or it needs to have some sort of an emotional impact, which is negative, then frankly, I'm still in the middle of my teen years, and now my early 20s, I don't want to read books like that. I want to read books that are uplifting. I want to read books that have happy endings, or I want to read books that you know, the bad guy gets it. I don't want this ending where it's sad, and I don't want to hear about these authors who are depressed and had drinking problems and spent their time alone and only wrote about depression and sadness. So obviously you could tell when I saw Silver Linings Playbook, I certainly could empathize with the character and with his frustration about that book. Anyways, I thought that was an interesting little story. But this is Book Therapy. I'm Rob Cohen, and it's been a few weeks. I've read a few books. Baseball season is just about over, so that means a lot more time for reading. You know, it's interesting. I heard a statistic today on another podcast that the average person will read 600 books in their lifetime. And when I thought about it, I thought that was kind of an interesting number because I went to my Goodreads page and I looked at the books that I've rated. And I only rate a book if I've actually finished it, I've read it from start to finish. And I think that on my list of rated books, I'm up to about 450. And I think, you know me well enough at this point to expect that 600 is probably already been far surpassed. I'm sure that there are at least 100 other books that I've read that I can't even remember at this point or that I haven't even rated on Goodreads. And So I found that an interesting statistic. What I also heard as far as another statistic is that the chances of reading 1,000 books in your time are pretty slim. Obviously, if you're a professional reader, you're going to read that. But if I'm reading, 30 or 40 books a year, it's going to take me an awful long time to get to 1,000. And it's an interesting concept, this idea that you could, basically we only have a finite amount of time to be reading, because that means that there are going to be books that one way or another I'm never going to get to read, books that will sit on my bookshelf and I'll be saying, that's the one I'm going to read next, or I'm going to read next, or I'm going to read next, and for whatever reason I won't get to it, and then I won't get to it, I'll never get to it. But I guess the opposite would be the situation in which you wake up one day and find out that you've read all the books you want to read, and there's nothing on your bookshelf to be read, and you go to the bookstore and you can't find a book that you want to read. I'd rather take the situation in which I can't read all the books I want to, as opposed to its opposite number. But I mean, there have been times when I've gone to the bookstore and walked around with the urge to buy a book, and nothing appeals to me, and can't find a book. Or other times when I've walked around, picked up books and looked at them and just thought, you know what, now's not the time. Whether it was early stage buyer's remorse, or for whatever reason, I just didn't feel the need to buy a book at that point. And whether I came back to it or not, I can't even tell you. I don't remember. It happened to me last week. I went to Barnes & Noble. I picked up a book or two. And as I'm saying there, I'm thinking about all the books that are on my shelf to be read, thinking about all the books that I do want to read, and just couldn't bring myself to buy these books. So, it's an interesting study. I did read a few books. I wanted to talk about them. Briefly, I don't want to get too much into the details of some of the books, as you know, as we discussed, I'm a bit of a fraidy cat, and there's a book that I'd been interested in reading since I'd heard about it on a podcast and since I'd seen it come up on Amazon. And it's a book called Night Film by Marisha Pessl, P-E-S-S-L, and I knew that it was going to be a difficult book. I knew it was going to be a book that was going to challenge me psychologically. It was going to be a book that would scare me. It would be a book that I anticipated would give me nightmares. And I had to strategically plan when I was going to read this book, because I didn't want to read it during a weekend in which my wife was away. I didn't want to read it at a time in which I needed to get good sleep, because I just kind of knew that this was going to be a book that disturbed me. And yet, I also felt this need to read the book. It's one thing to, I'm in awe of people who can write books, and to take words and formulate sentences that formulate paragraphs, that formulate chapters, that formulate books, it's an amazing accomplishment. But I'm also quite a fan of books that are of alternative structures. Now, I'm not saying poetry books or books that are told in verse. Those are books that I typically will try to stay away from. But books that utilize different methods of telling the story, whether it be flashbacks or journal entries, or books that are told in the form of letters back and forth between people. And this book, Night Film, really stretched even my own concept of what could be a method of telling a story, because it utilized fabricated newspaper stories, fabricated magazine articles. It even had pictures of people who I couldn't tell who they were. It utilized fabricated websites. It utilized fabricated movie pictures, and all in the method of telling a story, which really is a 21st century story, which is the tracking of the death of a woman who happened to be the daughter of a famous but reclusive filmmaker. And as I was reading the book, I could definitely feel that there were aspects of it that harkened back to an Alfred Hitchcock type of a story. And the idea that there was something nefarious and maybe even evil and supernatural about the circumstances of the death, and yet you always knew that somewhere back there was a reasonable explanation for what happened. And yet this book still disturbed me. It still gave me nightmares. And a lot of the nightmares, by the way, came from the additional content, the newspaper articles and the magazine clippings, because it was tangible. It was pictures of real people, whether they were actors, which I'm sure they were, or it was archived pictures from Getty Images or something like that. I mean, they were real people. And as somebody who has a very difficult time with an imagination, where I frequently have trouble picturing events, I frequently have trouble picturing what characters look like or what locations are like, that I think does insulate me a little bit from what can be a disturbing aspect of a book, because if I can't picture it, then it's difficult for me to focus on it. I can't imagine the events taking place because I don't have that level of creativity or imagination. But when the book basically does the work for you and it gives you images that at least it gives me images that my mind can focus on and that my mind can then continue to go back to at times where I'm having difficulty sleeping or at times where I'm trying to maybe distance myself from the book, it definitely creates a more troublesome experience for me. And so for all that being said, I anticipated that it was going to be an uncomfortable reading experience, but it was also something that I really wanted to experience because of the additional content and really the use of 21st century technology to tell this story. In fact, the book itself also has an app for your iPhone or Droid that you could scan your phone over certain pictures in the book and it would give you additional content. And I tried to do it once and it didn't work. And after having read the book and being thoroughly disturbed at points and having the sleepless nights and having the nightmares, I didn't want to do it. You know, I didn't want to test my own my own inner constitution and see what this additional content was. One of them had to do with a copycat murderer, you know, somebody who saw how a murder was committed in one of the filmmaker's films and then tried to copycat it. It just was unsettling, and I didn't want to go back to it. So I can't tell you what that additional content was. But what I can say is that at the end, I felt was redeeming. I thought that there were holes in the story. I'm not going to talk about what those were. But I thought that what was interesting about the book and what really drew it back towards a Hitchcockian type thriller is the fact that through the whole book, you're being led down this path that there's a supernatural aspect to the situation. There's a supernatural aspect to the death of the woman who was killed, the daughter. There's a supernatural aspect to the myth that is this this reclusive filmmaker. That there's a supernatural aspect to all of the circumstances leading up to this death, and yet at the end, the reveal gives you the insight into the fact that it's quite possible that there is a legitimate reason for everything that happened, that there is a logical explanation for all the circumstances. And that to me certainly demonstrates a keen capability on the part of the author to really craft a story which has two potential answers and to lead the reader down one path and then provide the twist that gives a completely different perspective on it. It's really an amazing talent for a writer to have. Certainly we've seen it in movies where you're led down this path and then you find out that everything that you were led to believe is now incorrect, and it makes you want to go back and start from the beginning, and now you can read everything or you can watch this movie with the eye of knowledge that this is all, you know, made up, or that there is a logical explanation for all of this, and maybe you can pick out details and plot points and differences that are, you know, maybe these Easter eggs that give rise to what you should have picked up on at the time you were reading it. Now, as we talked about the last episode about making recommendations, I did recommend this to my brother, and he read it, and he liked it, and he thanked me for recommending it, although he did email after he'd read about 140 pages and asked me if the book was scary, because I think he had gotten to a little bit of the parts where it was starting to take a little bit of a sadistic turn, or a satanistic turn, I guess is the better terminology. But I'm glad he stuck with it, and he emailed me today and told me that he did enjoy it and he liked the ending. And I think the ending, for something as dark as this book was and as shadowy as the characters were, I found the ending to be quite uplifting. I actually found the ending a little bit more happy. I found myself to be a little more happy. I was satisfied with the ending. Even though the ending leaves you hanging, I was satisfied with the explanation that the author was providing as a potential contra explanation for the events. And even though we don't know or we're not told exactly what happened, I was comfortable with the plausible alternative that I was satisfied with the ending. And usually I'm not satisfied with endings that are that don't resolve everything. I don't like being left hanging. A book that was from a while ago I read by Tana French called Into the Woods, which has been a widely read book and one that has been well celebrated. It left me hanging. I didn't feel that there was a closure to the book. And when I later learned out that the second and third book and the fourth book in the same world of the story does not come back to that first book and resolve those issues, it left me feeling as if the work was incomplete. And that did bother me. And that's an aspect of reading that I don't appreciate. I don't want to be left hanging. I want there to be closure. Now, look, if it's part of a series where it's a cliffhanger and then you pick it up next time or you pick it up a couple of books down the line, that's one thing. But, you know, to have it to be a standalone novel and not to resolve the issues, I just feel as if it's a long journey to have to go without being satisfied that all the loose ends have been tied up. And that I did not find with Night Film. I found that it did an inadequate job of resolving the issues, or at least giving a potential explanation for the issues, such that I didn't feel as if it was unfinished business. So that was Night Film. I don't really want to talk about it too much, frankly, because I don't want to think about it too much, because it'll probably dredge up a lot of the uncomfortable feelings that I had while I was reading the book. But the book I read after that, I kind of read out of a sense of obligation. It was the third book in the Clifton Chronicles by Jeffrey Archer, and this one was called Best Kept Secret. And it's a five-book series. This is the third book that's come out. The first one called Only Time Will Tell, second one, The Sins of the Father, and I guess the fourth and fifth books will be coming out in the next couple years. Now, I first read Jeffrey Archer when I was 13 years old, and it was a book that I'm sure many of you have heard of. It's a modern-day classic called Cain and Abel, and it was my first foray into this family saga type of literature, where it would follow, basically people or families throughout long periods of time. And I remember that after having read Cain and Abel, that my eyes were kind of open to this new genre. I read, Rich Man, Poor Man was in the similar vein, and read many other books that really tracked the same type of a story arc. And it was then that I really started to enjoy Jeffrey Archer's books. And Jeffrey Archer's books are widely diverse. I wouldn't say that Archer has a set specific genre that he writes, because he's written mysteries, he's written international intrigue, he's written adventure stories. One of the books that came out a few years ago was about explorers who were trying to climb Mount Everest in the turn of the century, the early 1900s. So he really doesn't have a specific genre, although I think that many people would agree that his strongest literary contributions have been in this family saga type of a genre. And one of my favorite books in general, let alone by Archer, is a book called As the Crow Flies. And I remember when it came out, I read it. It was probably the longest book I'd ever read. I think it was 800 or 900 pages. And it basically travels the length of the life of its main character. I still remember his name, Charlie Trumper, I'm pretty sure is what his name is. And he's an immigrant to the United States at the turn of the century. He starts out with a cart selling goods off of this cart, and he turns it into one of the largest department stores in the country. And I think it was a similar story to the rise of Marshall Field, which is a large department store in Chicago. And so this book, As the Crow Flies, was really I just remember really enjoying it, and there's a sense of being able to really invest yourself in the story when you know it's that lengthy, you know it's something that you're going to have to invest your time in, And you can really focus on the characters. You can really get taken in by the characters and start to feel empathy for them. And you can start to feel emotions for them. And you feel as if you're going through this journey with them. And since that time that I read that book, I've been looking for other books where I can also do that. And I found some of them along the way, whether it was North and South and Love and War by John Jakes, although I never read the third one, Heaven and Hell, and various other books that really have been these lengthy tomes, 600,000, 700,000, 800,000, 900,000 pages, where you need to invest the time, but you feel as if these characters, because you are spending so many hours with them, that they become much more tangible to you. And that's where I think that this latest round of Jeffrey Archer novels really fails. Because instead of taking this planned 5-book series and culling it down into one massive book, one 900 or 1,000 page book, they've made it into 5 separate books of like 350 pages each. And you gotta wait like a year or more in between books. So right when you start to get invested in the characters, the book ends. There's typically a cliffhanger or something that leaves you hoping, gasping for more, so to speak. And then you have to wait a year. And by that point, in my instance, I've read 50 books since then. I don't remember what happened. I don't remember who these characters are. And not only that, I don't remember what my emotional connection was to these characters that I can quickly pick it back up and be invested in the story again. And I know, I get it. It's capitalist society, and it's, look, why would we want to give it to you in one book when we can give it to you in 5 books and charge you for 5 books as opposed to charging you for 1 book? I get it. But it does the reader a disservice. Or it just plain does me a disservice. I mean, that's what do I care what everybody else thinks? And so for these books, The Clifton Chronicles, I really feel as if it's a disservice. And I could wait. I could wait until all 5 books are out in paperback and buy them all at once and just read them back to back to back to back to back. But then you get an editing problem. Because when you have these books that are a year apart, if you're the author, Jeffrey Archer, you know that the people who have read the books don't remember from one year to the next. And so you have to re-educate them as to what happened in the past. So if I were to tell you that in this latest book, the 360 pages or whatever it was, that there's probably 30 to 40 or even 50 pages in the book that are basically just retelling what happened in the previous 2 books, well, how can you read 5 books back to back to back like that? When each book you read, you're being reminded about what you just read. So if you were to take these 5 books and put them into one book, it wouldn't be 1,500 pages. 5 books at 350 pages could be, more than that, 1,600 pages. Because you'd be able to cut out all the fluff that is designed to re-educate the reader as to what happened in the past. So, it's a reading experience that is just going to be continually disappointing. And this book came out many months ago, 3 or 4 months ago at least. I bought it when it came out, and it's been sitting on my shelf. And the reason why it's been sitting on my shelf is because I didn't want to invest the time in trying to, reconnect with these characters or, refresh my memory as to who they are or try and figure out, okay, what happened again and why are we starting here and what's been going on and who are these people? Because as you know, I don't remember characters' names from one book to the next. I don't really remember storylines from one book to the next. And now that it's been over a year, I'm supposed to pick this book up and start back in the middle of a story that I don't really remember. But I've read 2 of the books already. I feel this sense of obligation to read the other 3. This one was fine. It wasn't great. It spent a lot of time dealing with some sort of an election, which, British politics to me is pretty dry and not interesting. And when you spend 100 pages talking about an election, it really is not terribly intriguing. There it's got the typical types of Jeffrey Archer traits. It's got the good guys. It's got the bad guys. It's the bad guys who, for some reason or another, hate this family and will do anything to get back at this family. There's usually the, the scheming or gold digging woman who has designs to separate the family and take one of the people away from all the others and that kind of stuff. And this one actually ended with a cliffhanger where there's an accident involving a car that two of the characters were in, and the closing lines are that one of the one of those characters had died, but we don't know which. So there's a cliffhanger, which is wonderful because when the next book comes out, I won't remember that there was this cliffhanger. And as I mentioned before, I don't reread books. I'm not a person who's going to go back, get the other books, and try and flip through it and refresh my memory. It's just not me. But I will give you an alternative method to doing this. So I understand not wanting to put these five books into one book because A, it might be too massive, or B, not as lucrative. But there's a similar type of a storyline or similar type of a pursuit which is being put on by Ken Follett. And his is a three-book series instead of a five-book series. And his books basically have a similar type of an idea. They travel across many generations throughout the 20th century, involving the same families of characters and showing how the families have been interacted with each other and have been caught up in the world's affairs during the 20th century. And the difference between those books and the Archer books are, whereas the Archer books are five books at 350 pages each, Ken Follett's books are three books at, gosh, I want to say it was like 800 or 900 pages each. And these things were massive. I think the first book was called Fall of Giants, and the second book, I can't remember what it was. And the third book, I think, is called Winter of the World. And it basically starts right before World War I, and then it will go all the way up to, I think, the 1980s, if I understand correctly, the third book. I think the second book ended right around the Korean War. And, I mean, it's just a fascinating and monumentous undertaking to create the storylines of these many different characters and their genealogy, the familial lines through the 20th century, while finding ways to have these characters interact with real people, interact with each other, interact with famous events. And sure, you know, some of these events are given short shrift. He doesn't spend a lot of time with some situations and spends more time with others. But, you know, this isn't a history book. It's literature. It's fiction. It's not designed to educate as to all of the politics and historical events that took place, but a way to tell you the story of these characters as the events of the 20th century have unfolded. And his books, by the way, separate from the Archer books, which I think are about a year apart, Ken Follett's books are 2 years apart. So I remember I read the first book while my second daughter was being born. That was in 2010. I read the second book. I think I was reading it on my daughter's second birthday in 2012. So I think it's another year from now, October of 2014, I think, when the last book will come out and the story will be completed. But that's still the type of a book to which I gravitate towards. I like those long family sagas. I loved The Winds of War and War and Remembrance. I really enjoy the families and how they interact with each other, how they interact with historical events and historical figures. I still remember reading, I think, Winds of War, and the main character, or one of the main characters, Pug Henry, who is a admiral in the Navy, who prior to the beginning of World War II is meeting with, you know, Adolf Hitler, and the type of detail and research that goes into, you know, crafting the scenarios in which the main characters are interacting with historical figures is really an astonishing accomplishment. Compared to Jeffrey Archer, who his books, these Clifton Chronicles, have now spanned, let me see, hold on, I'm going to look and see what year we're up to now. 1958. The book, the last book, Best Kept Secret, ends in 1958. And other than a few little details about World War II, where one of the main characters fought, very little discussion about historical events that are taking place at the time. I like Jeffrey Archer. I've enjoyed his books, but it seems to me like this series of books is being phoned in, because it doesn't look like it requires a lot of research. It doesn't look like it requires a lot of thought. It's kind of feels like a retread of some of his old stories, but told with different characters. And I do feel, a measure of obligation to read the rest of them, and I will read the rest of them, and then I'll put them on the shelf, and that'll be that. But these are not classic Archer. I certainly would love to. I would rather go back and read, As the Crow Flies or Cain and Abel again. But as you know, I don't reread books, so I'll continue with the Archer books, and I guess just hope that at some point he does make another attempt at a massive undertaking of a Cain and Abel. But I think at his age, it's not going to happen. And, I guess having read Archer when he was in his prime is a little bit of solace for this reading experience. I've made mention of the fact that I have so many books on my bookshelf to read, and at times it feels like a overwhelming task to get through them all. Not one that I'm shying away from, because I certainly relish the idea of going back down to my bookshelf and picking out a new book to read. But it's made me be a little more selective, I think, with some of the books that I do read. Because I've got so many books to read and so many new books that are new authors I've never read before, or continuing series that I know are satisfying. I've tried to be more discriminatory about the books that I read. And this is evident in the recent release of a book by Richard North Patterson, which off the top of my head, I don't remember what the title is. But Richard North Patterson, when I was in my late teens and, up through the end of law school and maybe even a little later than that, I would have put him on the list of my favorite authors. He was a trial attorney who, like a John Grisham, like a Scott Turow, like Philip Friedman, wrote legal thrillers. And some of his books were just fantastic. Degree of Guilt, Eyes of a Child, Silent Witness, The Final Judgment. I mean, these were massive legal thrillers, talking 500-600 pages, terrific courtroom dramas, great trial strategies and testimony and wonderful mysteries. And I really, really enjoyed Richard North Patterson's books. And he then started to shift away from the legal thrillers and became more of a political writer. And there wasn't anything wrong with that, because his level of research and his level of intellect were so astonishing that these books were so exciting to read. He wrote a book about Roe versus Wade, or about the abortion issue. He wrote a book about gun control. He wrote a book about the appointment of a Supreme Court justice. And these were books that were massive and weighty and not books that you could just spin through over a weekend. They really required a lot of thought. And I think that was what truly elevated Patterson above some of his contemporaries, a Steve Martini or a Scott Turow or a John Grisham. Because, let's be fair, John Grisham's books are not deep books. And I read so many of them until I just decided I'd had enough. But there's nothing particularly deep or intellectual about the books. Grisham is not the best trial statistician. strategist. He's not. His strength is not trial testimony or portraying trials. His strength was in writing books that were easy for everybody to read, which had enough legal thriller to it. But involved characters that were identifiable. And I think that's where his strength really lay. But Patterson, I think, really distanced himself from these other contemporaries because he truly put in the work, I think is the best way to put it. And even after he stopped writing even some of the legal thrillers or the political thrillers that involved the U.S. government, because I think he wrote a book about, somebody running for president, a character running for president, he then went into some international politics. And he wrote a book which I think I would call amongst his best, which is not a legal thriller. It's not a domestic politics type of book. It was called Exile. And it involved the politics of the Middle East and Israel and the Arab nations. And it was just it brought the political tension of that location directly to me, because he took the reader into areas of of the Arab nations that we don't hear about. And as I was reading the book, I was trying to figure out how much of this stuff was created and how much of it did he really have access to, because he was taking us into areas which were not safe, where white people, let alone Jewish people, were not welcome. And he couched it in a way that was a compulsively readable story involving an Israeli what was she? She was a not a lobbyist. She was in favor of this movement. She was in the movement to strengthen Israel, and there was a legal battle about that, and it required the main character to go to Israel and to go to the Arab nation and really explore and investigate. And I thought it was a fascinating story. And again, it was one that was 500 or 600 pages, so you could really get into it. You could really roll up your sleeves and invest your time and go through this journey with the main character. Then I think Patterson started to drop off a little bit, because then the next book was called Eclipse, and it felt like it was a retread of this other book, Exile, but it took place in Africa or South Africa or whatever African nation it was. And I really felt like I had to struggle to get through it, because it felt too familiar and yet a little bit phoned in, and so I wasn't as excited by that as I guess I should have been or could have been. And then last year he tried to get back to his roots, I think, and he tried to get back to the family saga that has legal ramifications to it. Now, he wrote a book, I guess 15 or 20 years ago, called Silent Witness. And I don't remember too much about the book, other than I believe it involves the main character going back to his hometown for his high school reunion and finding out that his best friend, who was later no longer his best friend because this guy ended up marrying his high school sweetheart, there's a murder or a rape or whatever it is. And so it really the story kind of paralleled these two different time frames. The current day main character returning to his hometown for the reunion and the legal issues that occurred there. And then back in the 20 years previously, when everybody was in high school and there was this crime that had been committed. And the balancing of those two storylines was really pretty memorable about the book. And I think that Patterson tried to go back to that with this book that he brought out last year called Fall from Grace. And it was just a disaster. And I hated to say it, because I did have this affection for Patterson and his novels and have had so many good reading experiences with his books. But Fall from Grace, which should have been a book that I would gravitate towards, because it involved the passing of a patriarch of a family and the complex dealings with the administration of the decedent's estate, which is a lot of what I do for my profession. It simply felt too simple. I think the resolution was too easy, and I don't think that the characters were very well written. And fast forward to now, a year later, and Patterson has a new book out, and it involves those same characters. It's trying to go back in time to show these characters as they were in the 60s and 70s and how they grew up and how the family changed over time. And frankly, I don't have any interest in that. I was disappointed with the previous book. I didn't particularly like the characters. I felt that Patterson had done himself a disservice, because he didn't give it the level of research and effort that I'd seen him put into his other works. And so I just decided I wasn't going to read this. I wasn't going to put the time forward when I've got so many other books to read. And that's a difficult thing to do sometimes, because there's a level of comfort in the authors that I like. And even though they may not be the best books ever written, I am familiar with the writing. I'm familiar with the cadence of the dialogue. I'm familiar with, you know, it's a comforting thing to read an author that you know and that you are familiar with. And to make the decision that I wasn't going to read this book, and who knows, I may not read any more of Patterson's books. It really will have to depend on, you know, the subject and size. I mean, frankly, big books don't scare me, but little books sometimes do. You know, I'm not afraid of a 600-page book, but sometimes I'm afraid of a 300-page book because I'm afraid that in 300 pages, the author's not going to get everything done, or that the author's going to cut too many corners in order to get it into 300 pages. And I think that that's a sign of the times. I mean, look around. You don't see a lot of books that are written these days that are 500 and 600 pages. You just don't see them. Now, whether it's because these authors are being pressured to come out with books on a more frequent basis, that they don't have time to really invest to developing these stories and really putting in the time to make them, you know, weighty and lengthy, but you don't see it anymore. And too many books I've read that are 300, 325 pages that are in hardcover that you're spending $25 on, and you're getting the feeling as if you're getting a half-assed story, or you're getting a book that isn't as complex as it could be, or the resolution is too easy because the author needed to get it done and didn't want to make it too long. And so for Richard North Patterson, you know, I hope that he returns to his roots. You know, I hope that he goes back to writing the political thrillers and the legal thrillers, because he was, I would say, the most impressive of the bunch when I was reading all of those books 15, 20 years ago. So disappointing in myself, or disappointing for myself, that I had to make the decision not to read that book by him, and we'll see what the future brings. Now, that does bring me to the last book that I finished just a few days ago, called Identical by Scott Turow. Scott Turow, as we've discussed in the past, obviously was the father of the late 20th century movement towards legal thrillers with A Presumed Innocent. And it was the reason why I went to law school. It really, when I read that at 13 years old, it was the way that the characters thought and the strategy that was employed to tell the story was so impressive to me that I wanted to go to law school so I could think that way, and I could learn how to think that way. And I've pretty much stayed consistent with Turow's books, although he doesn't come out with books very often. I think it may be one every 3 or 4 years at this point. So when he does come out with a book, it's a bit of an event for me, although some of them I confess I haven't enjoyed. But this one had a little bit of an added interest to me because of the topic, and it involves identical twin brothers, one of whom is running for mayor of the city in which they live, which is the same city that all of the Scott Turow books take place in, the fictional center of Kendall County. And while the one twin is running for this mayor position, his identical twin is just getting out of jail after spending time in jail for 25 years for having murdered his girlfriend. Now, this book feels like the book that I just mentioned by Richard North Patterson called Silent Witness. It feels like that because it's got the murder from 25 years ago that is playing out, and at the same time, there's the investigation of that murder now 25 years later. The reason why, and it's a bit of an ingenious plot tool that Turow uses, because it's one thing to just tell a straightforward whodunit, to have a murder and then have the investigation take place. But that's easy. What Turow does is completely different. The brother has gotten out of jail. The other brother is running for mayor. And the brother of the girl who had been killed believes that the mayoral candidate had something to do with it. So he starts a smear campaign. And he starts to publicize the fact that the mayoral candidate had something to do with the murder of his sister. And in order to defend the lawsuit that the mayoral candidate files for defamation. The brother hires a former homicide detective and his internal security chief to investigate the murder from 25 years ago. It's ingenious. I mean, it's the same story. It's a whodunit 25 years later. But it's done in a way that it's not so obvious that it's a whodunit. I mean, it would be painting by numbers if it was told just this simplest way of 25 years later, still not sure who did it, so we're going to investigate the murder. Or it's a cold case. The person's been dead for 25 years and there's never been a culprit identified or an arrest made. But no. This is not a paint by numbers. This is Scott Turow. And I wonder if he feels an obligation after having really created this genre that was made so successful by John Grisham and Steve Martini and David Baldacci, the legal thriller genre that Scott Turow created. Does he feel a responsibility to be innovative and to come up with new? Because I think that if anybody writes a book that's a legal thriller, they're trying to imitate at this point a John Grisham, or back in the mid-1990s, they were trying to imitate a Scott Turow. But now, if Scott Turow comes out with a book which is a standard paint-by-numbers, legal thriller mystery, there's nothing special about it. So I definitely commend Turow on the plot choices that he made and the different method that he chose in order to basically tell the same story, which is investigating a murder from 25 years ago. But it was this added twist about the identical twins that really resonated with me, because I am an identical twin. And I don't understand the relationship that I have with my brother. Now, I know that there are so many people out there who don't. Nobody will get the relationship unless you're also an identical twin. And I'm constantly running into people who are twins or learning about twins. And I want to find out about their relationship, because I don't know whether the relationship that I have with my brother is indicative of the twin relationship or is indicative of being twins, or is it different? I truly don't know. Twins are an anomaly. They're an enigma. They're a genetic hiccup. They're strange. I drop my daughter off at school every day, and every morning there's a woman who's dropping off her daughter at school, and her daughter, she has two identical twin daughters who are not quite ready for school, but they all come together to drop off the daughter. And the twins are just creepy. I mean, they look alike, and they're always wearing the same clothes, and they just feel odd and strange. And I'm always curious about how the twin experience is perceived by non-twins. And I'm also curious as to how the twin experience is portrayed by non-twins. So I was interested to see how Scott Turow portrayed the twin relationship. And I've read other books in the past that have to do with twins, because call me, I don't know, a glutton for punishment, but I want to know and I want to read about the emotional relationship between twins. And frequently, the books that I've read involving twins deal with one twin who is dead or one twin who has some sort of a mental illness. And maybe I it's that thirst for the unknown that leads me to want to read how the twins are portrayed and how, whether I feel the emotional heart tug that is being portrayed in these books. There was a book that came out a few years ago that was a big success, which I hated, called The Memory Keeper's Daughter. And I think it had to do with twins that were either separated at birth, or twins where one of them was fine and the other one was mentally ill, or I don't remember what it was. And I only read it because it involved twins. And there was a book that I picked up last year called The Last Child by John Hart, which I wouldn't have picked up if it weren't for the fact it was about twins. And this one was about a little girl who had been killed, or no, who had gone missing, who had disappeared. And her twin brother was the only one who continued to search for her quite a few years after she'd gone missing. And I know that there's another book by Wally Lamb called I Know This Much Is True, which involves twins and the relationship between a normal twin and a mentally ill twin, which is on my bookshelf to be read. And that book is a lengthy book. I want to say it's 700 or 800 pages. And it's not that it's a daunting book to read, but it's really one that I need to get into the right mindset to read. Because I know it's going to be a struggle. I know it's going to be difficult to read. But books about twins intrigue me because I'm curious as to how the non-twin author portrays the relationship between twins. And that was just another reason why the Scott Turow book really why it appealed to me. And it was interesting because when people ask me what it's like to be a twin, my answer is I don't know anything different. But they don't know anything about twins. I mean, it's clear they don't. And they don't know about the unspoken language that they have, or whether there's a way to read each other's thoughts. Or I mean, when you think about it, identical twins have what should be the exact same genetic makeup. I mean, they're not clones, but they're the closest thing to clones that exist by natural production as opposed to petri dish. And so they're misunderstood, they're unknown, they're feared. Feared may be a strong word. People fear what they don't know. They're just not understood. And so I'm curious as to how they're portrayed. Now, Turow does a really good job, I think, of getting into the minds of the twins as they're perceived by other people and discussing and portraying what the relationship of twins are. And I'm going to read a passage. It's from one of the characters. She was married to one of the twins, and this is what she says. She says, "You learn a lot about love married to identical twins. It's not for everyone, especially if you want to feel like you're number one. They grow up in a world of individuals, and we all tell them to think and behave like us, but they can't. Their fundamental experience is different. It's probably the ultimate bond." Now, it's interesting. That's accurate. It's really accurate. Now, it's interesting that the character then goes on to say, as she's revealing the actual events that took place in the 25 years earlier, the murder, she says, with respect to one of the twins, "But more than that, he just couldn't tolerate the idea of his brother bearing that kind of trouble without him sharing it." And I think that's accurate. At least with me, and you got to think that Turow did his research and talked to other identical twins and found out how the bonds of the two are together. But you know, when I feel or when I hear that you know my brother is having any type of trouble or is going through any type of stress or strain, it's kind of inherent in me to not want him to go through that by himself, to want to do everything I can to help him. And I think that's same for a lot of siblings, but I think it's heightened in identical twins. And fraternal twins are completely different. Fraternal twins are just two different people. They're siblings who were just happen to be born at the same time. But there's nothing specific about their relationship that creates this inherent bond. And I find that relationship fascinating. I will continue to read books about twins just to explore that further, because I am curious as to how non-twins perceive the twin relationship, because people don't understand it. People don't. My wife doesn't understand it. It took me a very long time to come to the understanding that being married meant that my wife was my best friend, because I always had a best friend. I had always had somebody to play with. I was never alone. And when our first daughter was born and she would go and play, I would feel really, I would feel unhappy. I would be sad when I would see her off playing by herself, because I never played by myself. I always had somebody else to play with. And, you know, that's different from even fraternal twins, because fraternal twins don't have to play with each other. In a lot of instances, fraternal twins are off sex. They're boy-girl twins. So they're playing with different things because they have different interests. Genetically, they're predisposed to be, you know, Tonka trucks and Hot Wheels as opposed to Barbie dolls and playing dress-up. So even fraternal twins are not necessarily going to be playing together constantly. And yet, I think it's that consistent companionship that I have with my brother that has developed this strength, this strong bond, and that relationship. Now, is this an issue of nature versus nurture? I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, that's a fascinating topic to look into. But as far as the book goes, Scott Turow, Identical, I recommend it. I enjoyed it. It could have been longer. I interested as I was reading it. It would have been interesting to see how this was handled with if Richard North Patterson had been writing it, because that was kind of what I was thinking. It was told in that same kind of a mode. But I enjoyed it. It was well worth reading, and it will be another few years at least before Scott Turow comes out with his new book. So I guess I'll have to wait. Now, the book I'm reading now, which is going to be a while, I think, is called Donna Tartt. And now I'm blanking as to what it's called. Okay, now this is bugging me. Oh, that was odd. The Secret History by Donna Tartt. It's about, I think, 20 years old. I think it was written early 90s. And the only reason why I picked it up is because various of the podcasts that I listen to have mentioned this book as being amongst the best in literature over the past 20 years. And it supposedly has a suspense thriller type of feel to it. It takes place on a college campus. I get the feel of like a Dead Poets Society kind of a thing. A small group of students who have an intimate relationship with their professor, and somehow they, and it's no surprise, I mean, you learn in the first page, they end up murdering one of their classmates who's in this close inner circle. I'm about 100 pages into it. It's like 500 or 600 pages. So I knew when I picked it up, it was going to be a bit of an investment of my time. And so I was looking forward to it. But one of the things I have difficulty with, the book takes place current day, which I guess was the early 90s, because that's when the book was written. And yet I can't help but picture, you know, like a school ties, Dead Poet Society kind of a feel where, you know, we're talking 50s and, you know, early 60s. Everybody walks around with tweed jackets with elbow patches and ties, and everybody's all prim and proper. So I get a little bit of a feel of, you know, anachronism when I read about, you know, a character saying something that's thoroughly modern, because the way I picture it in my mind is this, you know, 1950s, 1960s feel of a New England college, you know, small campus type of a thing. But anyways, it's a book that everybody recommended based on this, or, you know, the podcast is talking about as being this wonderful literary fiction from the last 20 years. The author, Donna Tartt, just came out with a new book called The Goldfinch, so she doesn't certainly write books that often. I think this is the follow-up to The Secret History, so I think she's only written like 3 books. But we'll talk about that next time, and, you know, we'll see if what everybody said about the book is true. Because so far I'm 90 or 100 pages in, and doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. So anyways, that's it for this episode of Book Therapy. Find me on Twitter at BookTherapy13. This is Rob Cohen, and thank you for letting me lie on your couch.